Chapter 25. The Noblest Smuggling Operation in History. In the first week of 1985, Wilson hired a new administrative assistant, a 55-year-old Texan named Charlie Schnabel. Technically, Schnabel was supposed to spend his days in the small office next to the congressman, watching over the staff and making sure legislation was being tended to and constituents' problems were being solved. Strictly speaking, Schnabel, who had never been out of the country except for a brief visit to Mexico, and who had never given a serious thought to the workings of U.S. foreign policy, was expected to stay in the capital and certainly not to have anything to do with the CIA war in Afghanistan. But years later, Wilson's former assistant, Charles Simpson, would remark that the twin impact of his departure and Schnabel's arrival removed the one restraining influence that had previously kept Wilson somewhat straight. It may be hard to believe that anyone could outdo Charlie Wilson when it came to the art of rule-breaking, but Charlie Schnabel turned out to be every bit his boss's equal, and then some. Schnabel is a slow-moving man who wears cowboy boots, speaks with a southern drawl, and subscribes to Soldier of Fortune magazine. You see his type often on the dusty back roads of East Texas, driving a pickup truck, a rifle hanging on a rack in the back window, a hound by his side, heading off into the woods for a weekend of hunting. But he's also reminiscent of that breed of cunning southern lawyers who open trials by saying, "I'm just a country boy." Schnabel was nobody's fool. For 22 years, he had been Secretary of State of the Texas Senate, responsible for running the institution that Wilson's famous drinking friend Larry King immortalized in The Best Little Whorehouse in Texas. This experience taught him just about everything there was to know about the way things work in American politics. Over the years, he had broken in or done serious business with just about every major Democratic political figure ever to come out of Texas. He had watched over all the newcomers in their turn. On more than one occasion, the ever-understanding Secretary of State had carried Wilson home drunk in his arms. He'd gotten Wilson out of the jail, and had sometimes even managed to get his DWI charges dropped or modified. So prepared was Schnabel for the inevitable foibles of his many wild Texas charges in those days that he had the wife of the county prosecutor and the wife of the county clerk on his payroll. All of which is to say that Schnabel had not kept his post in the Texas Senate because he was a timid or cautious bureaucrat. As his wife Nadine commented one day when a visitor to their Capitol apartment noted how curious it was that her husband had a Soviet RPG grenade launcher, an AK-47 with a large supply of live ammunition, and other captured weapons from the Afghan War, "Oh, Charlie's rule in life is, don't pay attention to the rules." Schnabel was, in fact, something of a Texas legend, and in spite of his penchant for stretching the rules, the senators who had known him over the years never felt he had ever done anything bad. They figured that the Schnabels of the world are the ones who make the system work in spite of itself. There had been one embarrassing incident, a prosecution centering on a political favor he had done for a college sports program. He was indicted, but plea bargained his way out with a misdemeanor conviction. His old senatorial friends stood by him, and in a Wilson-esque statement, Schnabel remarked to the press, "I always like to do what I can for American sports." Wilson was not one to be put off by the accusations of some mean-spirited prosecutor, and in late 1984 he called Schnabel and asked him to take over Simpson's job as his administrative assistant. The answer was no. Schnabel had had many other offers to go to Washington over the years, but he liked his life in Texas. He liked his 120-year-old farmhouse near Austin. He loved his hunting and fishing, and he was a part of the life of the state, a man with so many debts owed him that he could almost live out the rest of his life just calling in the chits. "Don't say no," Wilson implored, and thus began a full-court press. "Don't worry about the hunting," the congressman said on the phone. "I'm on the Defense Appropriations Subcommittee, and anywhere in the world where we have a defense facility, you can fly there and hunt. They'll take care of you." This curious offer caught Schnabel's attention, so when Wilson sent him a plane ticket and spending money to come up to the Capitol to look it over, he accepted the invitation. He wasn't planning to be swept away, but the romance of Washington started to work on him, and Nadine, who had joined him on the trip, turned out to have relatives who lived nearby. She wanted to stay. The next day, Schnabel went out and bought a house, an act that he purposefully concealed from Wilson when he went in for a final chat. I told him I was still worried about the hunting, remembers the cunning negotiator. Wilson then iced the deal with a hard and fast repetition of his commitment. Don't worry about the hunting. In Schnapel's scrapbooks from these Washington years, gory documentation of Wilson having made good on his promise is revealed on page after page. The pictures show the congressman's AA in camouflage uniform near a military base, with bow and arrow by his side, holding up a gentle-faced Bambi by its antlers. In another location, Schnapel, with Texas Speaker of the House Gib Lewis, is grinning into the camera. The two good old boys are in northern Pakistan, on the Silk Route from China, in search of the nearly extinct Marco Polo sheep. The animal is very much on the endangered species list, but Schnapel explains proudly that President Zia himself waived this prohibition and provided the congressman's esteemed assistant with an official guide and a Mercedes to hunt the beast. In another picture, we see Schnapel beaming as he presents Zia with a 10-gallon hat, custom-made in Texas for the Muslim dictator. One particularly gruesome set of photos reveals a pickup truck piled high with deer from the grounds of the Indian Head, Maryland Navy Base. Schnapel explains that this deadly harvest of deer came from the night he led a SEAL team on a hunting spree, everyone wearing night vision goggles and shouting Allahu Akbar before unloading their high-powered weapons into the unsuspecting prey. The resulting venison, properly blessed before slaughter, was then given to a collection of visiting Afghan fundamentalists. In a sense, Washington never knew what hit it when Charlie Schnapel came to town. To a certain extent, Charlie Wilson didn't either. Until Schnapel's arrival, Wilson had worked the Afghan account in Congress all alone. His defense staffer rarely knew what the congressman was up to. But Schnapel is a self-starter with a gift, if not a genius, for getting along with people, and he began making friends with the Mujahideen who visited the congressman's office. In the beginning, Schnapel admits, it was not so much the purity of the Afghans' cause that got to him, as much as the romance of it all and the fact that it was just exciting, just so much goddamn much fun. I talked to these Muj when they came into the office and asked them, what can I hunt in Afghanistan? I want to kill something. And they'd say, come to the Panjshir, it's the greatest hunting in the world, the Panjshir Valley. So, while other adventuresome Americans who became fixated on Afghanistan always wanted to go to the Panjshir to meet Ahmed Shah Massoud, the great Mujahideen leader, Schnapel was drawn to Massoud's valley for very different reasons. He was desperate to go because the Panjshir is where you find the Marco Polo sheep and the ibex. When it came to all things to do with Afghanistan, Wilson's relationship to his administrative assistant was eccentric in the extreme. The two never really coordinated their efforts, and Wilson rarely chose to include Schnapel in his CIA dealings. But he always encouraged his AA's Afghan interests, and before long the two men had worked out an implicit understanding of the rules of engagement they would follow. It went something like this. Schnapel had Wilson's blessings to intimidate bureaucrats in his name. He could smuggle contraband to the Mujahideen. He could also carry stationery from the office, write letters requesting unusual assistance from, say, the Pakistan Intelligence Service, and sign them Charles Wilson. All of this Schnapel was empowered to do, and as his passion for the Afghan cause grew, he came to operate with such frequency and effectiveness in Wilson's name that Abdul Haq, one of the legendary Afghan commanders and a favorite of American reporters, remarked, "We used to think of the two Charlies as one." And President Zia, after receiving a 10-gallon hat, took to affectionately calling Schnapel the other Charlie.